From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Alexander Mercouris in London, sitting in for Eric Dratzer and Mark Sloboda in Moscow. Alex and Mark, welcome. Alex, welcome to your first time here at CPR Sundays. Glad to have
you. Hello.
Okay, so a lot going on in and around Syria and Ukraine. Let's start, Mark. Why don't you give us a sketch of what's happening on the ground?
Okay, a sketch of what's happening on the ground. First of all, Russia has decided to respond to the Turkish downing of the plane, besides the raft of political and economic measures, which aren't particularly serious, although, they do have certain implications for future Russian-Turkish ties, especially not continuing the Turk Stream pipeline, putting that on suspension, a nuclear power plant deal, and so on. But more importantly, Russia is concentrating on defeating and escalating the air campaign in support of the Syrian Arab Army to defeat Turkey's Erdogan's proxy forces that are fighting in Syria, most particularly these so-called Turkmen groups, which are al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, groups headed up by Turkish nationalists consisting of Chinese Uyghurs and Central Asian jihadists in northern Latakia. They have really pounded the area from the air, and Syrian Arab Army forces, together with some Hezbollah assistance, are rapidly mopping up town after town right along the Turkish border here. So this whole object of what Erdogan was trying to defend and protest against, I believe, with the downing of this plane, may have been lost to him. At the same time, the Syrian Arab Army is continuing operations north of Aleppo. There is a race on to close this Jarablus Afrin corridor, about 100 kilometers from the Syrian Syrian-Turkish border north of Aleppo, between two Kurdish-held cantons that is being used by Turkey and by the CIA to funnel weapons and supplies continuously to the various jihadist flavors in Syria. We're talking about al-Qaeda, Jabhat al-Nusra. We're talking about its offshoot, Ahrar al-Sham. We're talking about the U.S.-backed FSA, which is a little more now than a subset of al-Qaeda designated to hold the American tow weapons, the anti-tank weapons, and as well to ISIS. And Deutsche Welle, the respected German journalistic the media source, a year ago put up an extensive detail of this corridor, pushing trucks back and forth continuously from Turkey to and from Turkey and ISIS-held territory. They've put out video showing long streams of trucks going back and forth. They did a detailed report. This was largely ignored in the rest of the media and by the the political governments of the world, because up till now the game has been pretending that Turkey is not a state sponsor of terror, locked in a war to overthrow the Syrian government next door via regime change via proxies. Principally because the United States, the UK, the Saudi government, and all of the other its allies in the Gulf Cooperation Council were all in on this deal. And the New York Times has previously reported how the U.S. Has CIA and special forces all along this stretch that are supposedly managing the flow of weapons to the right groups. So any idea that they don't know what's going on there, continue this with the U.S. air base at Incirlik in Turkey that are flying F-15s continually along the Syrian-Turkish border, as well as Patriot missile batteries, which I believe are still there, although it's been announced that they will be removed, and the heavy satellite focus of the area, which we've seen U.S. releasing satellite images of Russian military installations in Syria air bases, but they certainly haven't been at all watchful or giving any information about this continuous flow of trucks, oil tankers back and forth between Turkey and Syria, in particular ISIS. The Russian reports, they detailed this week, the defense ministry presented satellite images. They presented three pathways. They showed where they're originating in Syria and Iraq, and which refineries they're going to in Turkey. They implicated Erdogan's family, his son in charge of the energy ministry, personally. Very detailed information, all of which is, of course, completely ignored because the mantra is denial, 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 no matter the evidence. The Russian reports show that at a height of 4,000 to 5,000 feet, the stretches of convoys of oil tankers going to Turkey from ISIS stretches beyond the horizon.
In both directions. Yeah.
In both directions. This is absolutely industrial scale. This isn't one lone truck on a road. This is continuous convoys, hundreds, thousands of trucks and tankers moving back and forth.
Putin called it a pipeline. President Putin called it a virtual pipeline.
It is a virtual pipeline. It is exactly that. And you're right. He said exactly those words. Now, Russia is also building a second air base, according to reports. They're not 100% confirmed, but they seem very reliable. They are moving more ground attack fighters and multi-role aircraft, both for air-to-air and air-to-ground combat, into Syria. They have heavily escalated the number of artillery units that they are using in support of the Syrian Arab army, and it seems likely to me that much of these are probably behind the front lines, but being run by Russian military crews. These include such things as the Buratino thermobaric weapon, which is a truly devastating and horrific battlefield weapon, it must be said, but extremely effective. Iran is also sending thousands of troops reportedly will be basing aircraft in Syria as well, according to some reports. At the other end of the scale, the U.S. has just announced another $500 million, Obama signed the NDAA, will be going to support rebels in Syria. On top of this, he has gone back on his promise, I think for the third time now. He said 16 times previously that there would be no combat troops in Iraq and Syria, and he has broken that promise again. And the U.S. is giving some indications that it may send vastly increased amounts of troops, perhaps in the thousands, into Iraq. The Iraqi government has responded to this quite angrily, saying that they will, regard this as a violation of the withdrawal agreements. They don't want them there. They don't need them there. And Iraq's Shiite militias, the most powerful force against ISIS in Iraq, have said that they will hunt and attack U.S. forces. On top of this, just last night, it's announced that supposedly a deal cut by the Barzani clan in Kurdish-held Iraqi north and the Erdogan government. Erdogan has sent somewhere between hundreds and over 1,000 Turkish troops into Iraq's Kurdish-held areas where they have previously bombed forces fighting ISIS before, the PKK, have done so in the last 2 weeks, actually, since the downing of the Russian plane. And that the Iraqi government calls in Baghdad calls this an invasion. They demand that they leave, haven't taken any military action yet. But what we see here is quite obviously the U.S. And its allies are not only bent on dividing Syria along geographic and sectarian lines, but obviously with an uncooperative government in Baghdad that is leaning closer to Russia, they're indicating that they're willing to do the same with Iraq as well, with the Barzani controlled government in Iraq's Kurdistan. Openly associating with Turkey against the wishes and the sovereignty of the government in Baghdad. Plus, there are indications that there's an illegal oil smuggling route from this Kurdish area in northern Iraq that runs parallel to the ISIS oil convoys into Turkey. And the weapons and arms and aid can be supplied via this route to ISIS as well. So we see Kurds basically against Kurds. And now we see Turkey allying with some Kurds against other Kurds and against Russia and Syria. And the picture now is so complicated and so convoluted, but it's escalating more every day now with Britain and Germany joining the air war as well above Syria's skies. Despite the Russian air defense S-400 in the region, things are very, very tense. They're escalating, they're snowballing, getting more complicated all the time, and things are looking worse and worse and worse.
Now, Alex, you could jump in to and add to anything Mark said, one thing that I notice is that the situation with Iraq in particular is interesting, given what just happened with the government that's in place now is more or less the product of the U.S. getting rid of Maliki.
And, absolutely. And yet the interesting thing is that it's actually, as Mark said, slowly drifting away from the U.S. because however it was created, it is still the Iraqi government and it has certain interests in Iraq. Now, Mark talked about the Turkish incursion and the Iraqi government referring to it as an invasion. Let's be quite clear, legally it is an invasion. Right. It was not done with the permission of the Iraqi government. Right. So the Turks, with the support of the NATO powers, have and are at this moment in time invading Iraq. Just as when they shot down the Russian aircraft over Syria, they invaded Syria. And right. when they bomb people in Syria without the permission of the Syrian
and Iraq
and Iraq, that is an invasion as well. I think that this issue of legality is not one we should overlook or forget, because of course when people invade other countries, whatever nice reasons they give for doing so, that is an act of aggression, and it is these multiple acts of aggression that are behind the international crisis and tension which Mark has so skillfully described. That is why we have this situation there. If on the other hand, all of these powers that say that they want to fight the Islamic State, ISIL, ISIS, Daesh, whatever you call it, if they really wanted to do so, they have partners on the ground in Iraq and Syria in the form of the governments of those countries who would support them and who would work with them. The fact of the matter is they don't. That is not their priority.
Yeah, and while all of this is going on, I've been watching this unfold, like we all have, over the last year and a half in particular, or 2 years, with the placement of all kinds of NATO military assets all along Russia's western border, mm-hmm. then last year the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And, it's been slowly, tightening and tightening the incidents with China in the South China Sea and all of that stuff, and the exercises of Korea and everything. And now, just today or yesterday, we see NATO moving naval assets into the Black Sea at the same time that the Ukraine is pushing an offensive up at the lines at Donbass. What the hell's going on?
Well, it is a policy of continuous confrontation, which is continuously escalating. And people talk about the deteriorating international situation, it should be quite clearly said that this deterioration in the international situation is willed, it is intentional, and it is the product of a policy of confrontation that certain people in the United States and the other Western powers have towards countries like China, primarily, Russia, also, to a very great extent, and Iran too. And that is really what is the source of the crisis. And it is in the middle of all of these, the fissures, if you like, that is created by this policy of confrontation, which is never publicly declared, that you have groups like Daesh emerging in Iraq, and you have neo-fascist groups emerging in Ukraine. Without this policy of confrontation, which is constantly looking to put pressure on these powers, we would not have that kind of situation.
Mm. And then you have like this kaleidoscope of confrontations too that take place in multi dimensions. You have the military stuff which you can place on a map. You've also had this ongoing war against oil prices, basically by the West, and with the complicity of Saudi Arabia, with them as actually the principal agent among the others. And then we learn of this. A pretty large oil smuggling, not as large on scale as, say, Saudi Arabia's share of the market, but this large subsidy to this, where Saudis and others get to keep their stuff under the well cap, and there's trading in stolen oil, which of course brings a much lower overhead to it.
Well, precisely. And of course, there are all sorts of people who benefit from it indirectly. And that is also been going on and on a massive scale. And
when we talk about people who are benefiting indirectly of that, let's be clear. We mean the people of the European Union, because who is buying, other than the oil that's consumed domestically by Turkey? Who is Turkey exporting oil to? The EU and Israel.
And
so they are, once again, not just the arms, jihadists and supplies that are going there, once again, indirectly supporting and fueling the ISIS, which has now struck ISIS and has copycat attacks in the United States and evidently London now as well with this machete attack on the
Well, indeed.
And it solves another problem, too, because when the U.S. forced the embargo, whatever, against Russia, sanctions against Russia, and started, dampening the availability of Russian oil and gas to Europe, and while this happened in the context of declining prices that made the U.S. unable to sell shale oil in its placement because it's too expensive, this stuff suddenly does some filling of some of the gap in the marketplace.
Well, indeed, of course. And if we go back to the multidimensional things that you were discussing, of course, we also have all these financial, the manipulation of the financial system, which is still controlled to a very great degree by the United States, also to achieve geopolitical objectives of the United States.
The IMF in particular. Propping up the regime with billions, tens of billions of dollars at this point, and now evidently willing to get its own long-held rules, not only to continue supplying a government that is waging war on its regime, that is waging war on its own people, we can't really call it a legitimate government, but it is also in default to its creditors.
And is it, in a sense, in effect, a form of bankrolling aggression, because that is what it is. Completely throws out all the rules that the IMF supposedly has, and it's been exposed as, in fact, that those rules simply don't apply if the geopolitical objectives of the United States stand in their way. Exactly. So we have this multidimensional push that is taking place, and that is what is causing the major escalation in tensions around the world that we've seen in Ukraine, we're seeing in Syria too, and which we saw in the South Pacific.
So I want to touch on that multidimensional aspect just a second for a bigger picture of what's going on. To some extent, we can still look at what is happening in the Ukraine and what happened back in 2008 in Georgia and I think we can add Libya into this, the discussion as well, as regional issues, particularly Ukraine and Georgia, only involved the West and its proxies against Russia. Now, there is definitely fight back against hegemonic policies, the U.S. trying to extend its control of geopolitical space further into the former Soviet space, against a Russia that is trying to organize things politically along the lines of the Eurasian Union, which Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, spoke openly against as the re-Sovietization of the Soviet space. I guess by the same measures we can call the European Union, the re-Nazification of Europe, or the APEC as the resuscitation of the Japanese co-prosperity sphere. So it's ridiculous. It's all about hegemony. And they have made very clear that you know that is behind the West's moves in the Ukraine and Georgia. But Syria is something, an escalation to another level, because with Iran and Iraq involved, Turkey, the Gulf states, Syria is what we're seeing is very much a proto World War III in development. This is the first true battle, and I certainly won't be the last one, of the multipolar world. And, this will help determine its elephants. At issue is basic facts of international law, the defense of sovereignty, not being able to overthrow governments from the West, you know, the end to the policy of regime change, whether it's directly or by proxy, interference and color revolution coups. A number of forces, in particular Russia and Iran, and we all know that China is the silent partner backing both of them up on this, openly resisting the West and their Gulf Cooperation Council allies. And at fate is regional control, hegemony over the Middle East at this point.
You know, there was a Foreign Affairs Committee meeting on Tuesday.
Yes.
And one of the committee members, Representative Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii, she's a Democrat.
God bless her.
was the first one in Congress, including Rand Paul, to my knowledge, that asked someone in public the following question. She started with, how many nuclear weapons do Russia and the United States have aimed at each other? And what would the consequences be of a nuclear war? Aren't we at the front lines right now shooting at each other? We're about to shoot at each other. And isn't it escalating? And what are the consequences for everyone? And why are we engaging in this over Syria?
Yeah, she even more clearly enunciated it in another interview
with Wolf Blitzer,
many with Wolf Blitzer on CNN. And she said outright, is our policy of regime change in Syria important to us that we are over and considering who these actual the alternative to the Assad government, be it Jabhat al-Nusra, ISIS, Ahrar al-Sham, whatever 31 flavors of jihad you want. Are they worth going to war with Russia over? She said it outright directly whether the responder was Ashton Carter, the defense secretary, or Wolf Blitzer, they immediately tried obfuscation as the means of directly answering that.
You know what got me was when she was doing the interrogatory with Ashton Carter, the defense secretary of the United States, the first thing she asked was how many weapons, and he didn't know. He said, I'll get you those numbers, but it's a lot.
Well, an incredible fact. But of course, the point about people questioning whether Assad is worth it is that, of course, that's a political statement that we've heard. But if you ask people all over Britain, there are lots of people outside the political elite who question it. And I was involved in a demonstration recently outside the House of Commons before a vote to bomb Syria, which is, as I said, an illegal bombing of Syria. And there, of course, everybody was saying it. So though it is something that is starting to break through with one this one isolated comment at a political level, mm-hmm. at an elite level, there are an awful lot of people in the West who actually feel that. And I wonder, actually, talking about Syria, and I, by the way, completely agree with what Mark says, this is almost a proto-war situation. But it is a war situation where I think if we get into a confrontation, political resistance will grow. That's what I think.
And now you've got a shooting war taking place in Ukraine again, and of course the this is after a period of U.S. And NATO military training and placement of assets, including their own troops. Suppose we end up with, say, an American casualty who's there supposedly training or advising or buying coffee for the Ukrainian government, ending up as a casualty.
It's no coincidence that the blockade of the Crimea by these Crimean Tatar extremists, the Mezhlis, alongside of the right sector neo-Nazi paramilitary battalions, with the obvious blessing of Kiev as the leader of the Tatars in the region, Jamilov is not only a member of the Ukrainian Rada, but got into the Ukrainian Rada on the President Poroshenko's party ticket. Mm-hmm. They blew up the pylon, as well as a food blockade that had been trucking blockade that had been going on for some time, which had no noticeable effect because Crimea is already well supplied via ferry from Russia. But they blew up the power infrastructure pylons, which send. Still send electricity into Crimea. Russia is at the has been building bridges between the over the Kerch Strait between Russia mainland and the Crimea that will provide both train truck travel, but also supply power and internet lines as well. And the first one of those was finally installed a little bit early this week, but. The Crimea has, up until just this week, been without power for 3 weeks because of this. And it's obvious that this was the chessboard is multi-tier. And when Russia is fighting back in Syria, the pressure goes on to the people of the Crimea and in this form of collective punishment. And can we just say that denying food and electricity to a civilian population is an obvious crime against humanity? It's been called as such in Gaza, but no one really cares in the Western press because these are pro-Russians in Crimea, the pro-Russian, the Russian ethnic and pro-Russian people of Crimea. So no one cares if they're without electricity or food. And there have been a lot of indications that Turkish military intelligence, MIT, is clearly backing these Crimean Tatars. There's a lot of links there. And the Western press continues with the blanket denial that we don't really know how these pylons were blown up, even as a Crimean Tatar flag is draped around them, the flag of this Mezhlis, this extremist. The Jamilov, the self-declared leader of the Mezhlis, claiming to represent the entirety of the Crimean Tatars, says, if you release some of our people, some of our extremists who have committed terrorist attacks plotting terrorist attacks in the Crimea, then we'll allow the restoration of one pylon. Because they've actively been blocking the restoration of power while the Kiev government says, oh, they're blocking us. There's nothing we can do about it. We can't move them aside. Now, you might say that Russia should have planned things better about supplying things to Crimea before they went about all of this. And obviously, they're correcting the problem now. But it also has to be taken into account the inevitable logic of this, because Ukraine as a whole gets almost all of its energy, be it gas, oil, electricity, nuclear fuel from Russia. And Russia has quietly responded by ending coal shipments to Kiev. But of course, they managed to put in a good stock, and they are now getting reverse gas quite heavily and illegally from Slovakia and much of the rest of the EU. And they think that can tide them through the winter. But this is a multi-tier chess game, right? If Russia makes advances in Syria against the wishes of Turkey, NATO, which, you know, of course, are the same entity, then there's pushback in the Crimea, and this pushback is taken against the Crimean people.
Now, let's
Can I just make one point about this power blockade, which is, of course, that for almost as long as I can remember, at least for the last 10 years, we constantly hear people talk about how Russia uses energy as a weapon, how it threatens to cut off energy supplies to various people who don't agree with it politically. Well, now it's been done, and it's not been done by the Russians. It's been done against the Russians by a Western ally with the tacit support of the Western powers. Because let's be absolutely clear about this, silence in this kind of situation implies consent. There hasn't been a single public criticism by any Western government, except a very tepid one by the German government, against what has happened.
The context for that, by the way, is that Western ally, Ukraine, Russia didn't cut off energy supplies to Ukraine for better than a year after not receiving a check from Ukraine, and Ukraine essentially declaring war against Russians inside Ukraine or in Novorus.
Well, exactly. I mean, it shows precisely where the aggression is coming from. It is not coming from the Russian side.
Well, now, taking what Mark just said about a tit for tat, essentially. Russians make an advance and Syrians make an advance in Syria, so they heat up the conflict in Ukraine. Over the past week, China made it clear that they agree with Russia's position with respect to terrorism, that there are no good and bad terrorists, and that they supported what Russia was doing in Syria.
And crucially, they noted that the Russia's operation in Syria, unlike the operations of the West in Syria, is entirely within the bounds, legal, and in the spirit of international law and the UN Charter.
And before we get to the fact that there seems to be a breakdown in earnest, in advance of, or at least during this proto-World War III, of that entire order, can we expect a tit-for-tat in the South China Sea or elsewhere around China for their taking a position there, particularly after the IMF, going back to that, decided to that they're going to take China's currency into the basket?
I think we will see a tit-for-tat. I mean, there's been increasing a push by the U.S. fleet in this area, and the U.S. is trying to build an alliance, basically, against China amongst the Southeast Asian powers by playing on historic fears against China. I think it's a very dangerous situation, actually, because the Chinese, for entirely understandable and valid historical reasons, see the South China Sea as not only their cultural and geographical space, but an area that is absolutely vital to their economic and national security. So I think they will resist any pressure by the US there. And I think the US is playing with fire, actually, by pushing there. But I don't know to what extent people in the United States understand this.
Let's take a look there at how Obama's statements about the shooting down of the Russian plane are such incredible hypocrisy and actually are so very dangerous for America's national security interests, because they fully backed what Turkey did, even if we take the assumption, which seems completely fallacious, that Russia violated Turkish airspace for 17 seconds, and that's what gave them the pretext to shoot this plane down. The U.S. and NATO both firmly stood beside that decision, with Obama saying directly, Turkey has a right to defend itself, to defend its borders. Now, if we extend that logic, that if you fly over someone else's airspace for a few seconds, if indeed that's what happened, and it looks like it was the opposite, that Turkey actually went into Syrian airspace to shoot down this Russian plane. But if we take that as a granted, that would mean that U.S. planes are a legitimate target, both above Syria, where they are violating Syrian airspace and they're not cooperating or with the Syrian government, which they have declared to overthrow, but also in the South China Sea, where China claims sovereignty. And there are good reasons over these atolls and islands in the Spratlys and elsewhere. The U.S. is flying and doing drive-bys with their naval within the territorial limits and airspace. That would mean that China has every right to shoot down any U.S. plane or ship that violates its territorial boundaries. And that is a very dangerous and very stupid thing for Obama to have said.
Especially in the face of S-400s. They've got
S-400s. So stupid, in fact, that there are, in fact, some ex-retired members of the U.S. military who have actually made it. I mean, there's been some comments from U.S. Air Force.
Yes, Dunlop in the National Interest, an excellent
Okay, so... Where is this headed? In fact, I want to jump somewhere else for a moment because you have all these points of contact that are turning into points of conflict. This whole push, the forward push by the Obama administration militarily after coming in essentially as being perceived as an anti-war candidate, certainly one that wasn't going to start any more stupid wars. And you can
he's actually still perceived that way in the U.S.
Yeah. Yes. And to me, World War III is a stupid war if there ever was one. but the battlefield, the original battlefield,
we can win it.
The original battlefield was Africa. They took Libya out and installed AFRICOM across the continent. Now you have President Xi there, making business deals and building alliances across the African continent. And then the other point of contact is Latin America. And you had a squeaker victory for the right-wing candidate in Argentina with massive U.S. support of that. And now the essentially the declaration that there's going to be a coup attempt by the right if they aren't declared the winner of today's election in Venezuela.
Yes.
So almost every place that there is... a conflict between the U.S. And EU on the one hand and Russia and or China on the other, or just national sovereignty on the other, it's heating up at this moment. Are we going to really look at like a global conflagration that's on like a runaway train?
Well, let's take a look at a second why we're seeing this being pushed to such an extent. It's because the whole hegemonic project, the unipolar moment, is fading. There is a very short window of time for them to exert as much influence and reassert control over the international order. In 10 to 15 years' time, China and Russia will be fully able not only to transcending from regional to truly global great powers, obviously in strategic alliance with each other, that will not only be able to defend their own territorial space, but to project power once again in confrontation with U.S. hegemonic power elsewhere around the world. We're talking not just militarily, but particularly with China. We're talking economically, where economically they use their economic power like the U.S. Uses its military power, particularly in Africa. We see that. Although China just announced this week that they will be getting their first naval base in Africa, which is an interesting development.
They're projecting that economic power into the Venezuelan election even. The government was able to announce that China's going to throw $20 billion at their economic problems.
Exactly.
Yes.
And as we've seen...
This oil war, this lowering of prices, for anyone who doesn't believe political, I'm taking a look at the three hardest hit targets, Russia, Iran, and Venezuela, outside of OPEC.
Go ahead. Let Alec finish his thought, too.
But if I can just say, that is interesting, because, of course, one of the big beneficiaries of the fall in oil prices is, of course, China. So if you try and manipulate things in this way, and this is the problem that the Eurasian states, if you like, pose, you can hurt one, but you risk, by doing that, strengthening the other.
Right.
And I think this plays in all kinds of interesting and strange ways. Now, in terms of the sort of global global situation. I completely agree, by the way, that we are looking at the fading of the unipolar moment, and that is an important fact to bear in mind, because I think that the latent economic and political power of the Eurasian states, if they all manage to come together, which I think they will, is overwhelming. The problem is that there are an awful lot of people in the United States who are not just invested in the unipolar moment and in US hegemony in simple power terms, they're also very invested in it in ideological terms. Yeah. Yes. And for them to actually see a situation where that moment is slipping and where history is going against them, that is extremely dangerous. And the nearest sort of vague approximation to that we had was in the 1960s, but nothing to anything like the kind of scale that we're looking to now. And that, I think, is what makes the situation particularly dangerous, because when people feel that their entire ideological belief system, if you wish, is becoming threatened, there is no knowing where they will go.
Well, the implications of that, of course, particularly affect political decision making. That ideological concept, the idea of American exceptionalism and all of that, as that erodes, that's about the only thing.
Has its own version of exceptionalism.
Well, it always has. It has since the beginning of the imperial age. But now, as that comes under challenge, in material terms around the world, that's the last thing that the working and middle classes have in the United States, given the decline in their economic and political power, precipitous decline in economic and political power over the last couple decades.
Absolutely. It is a belief system. And of course, if that belief system disintegrates and they are left with the fact that the United States is no longer the wave of the future, then of course that is going to start all kinds of problems within the United States as well. It might actually lead to challenges in the political and economic system within the United States, which the present beneficiaries of the system, and who are the beneficiaries of its ideology, are probably going to be very uncomfortable and unhappy with and won't want to face. So we have, I think, a more dangerous situation in the world than one we have seen at any time since the end of the Second World War. I think this is a much more dangerous time than the Cold War, when the United States never felt under the kind of pressures that it feels under now.
Yeah, including the Cuban Missile Crisis, in my opinion.
Including the
crisis. Mark, go ahead.
Because it's multi-spectrum. It's multi-spectrum going across the entirety of the world, and there are far more countries involved in it than just the Cold War bipolar Soviet-U.S. confrontation. That's where the added factor of danger, mistakes, misunderstandings, the erasing of the rules of the game, as it were, which were very clear, during the Cold War, no longer exists. One thing that Alex talked about before, and I just want to, I'm sure he'll agree with me here, but I just want to clarify for the visitors, benefit of the listeners. When we're talking about a Eurasian alliance against Western hegemony, we're not talking some kind of formal, ideologically based alliance that doesn't even exist in the actual Eurasian Union, much less between Russia and China and Iran. It doesn't have to be.
Right.
Exactly.
This is a strategic alliance. This is in defense of their mutual national interests, where they've seen too many countries, taken down when they oppose U.S. geopolitical interests, while whatever the nature of the regime, those that support it, like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, are the beneficiaries. But also in defense of the post-World War II UN world order, the defense of national sovereignty and non-interference.
The rule of law.
And I do completely agree with Mark. What Mark says. In fact, it is to some extent what we're seeing happening in Eurasia is a consequence of this constant push from the United States and its allies against them. Because they are under so much pressure, they are finding it necessary to come together. And the United States, in a strange way, in not actually such a strange way, is accelerating these processes in ways that might not have happened if there had not been this push. But certainly, Mark is absolutely right. We're not looking at anything like the kind of ideological conformism that we are now seeing in the West, with a single ideology, a neoliberal ideology, or if you like, a liberal ideology, which is basically becoming entirely hegemonic in the way that it is being imposed.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to have an ideology as a glue. Okay, and then you have heretics, and then you have a split in the ideological formation. But when you have self-interest, fundamental self-interests as the glue, unless those self-interests change, and when you're talking about existential questions, they rarely do, you have some very, very solid cement.
Exactly. And Mark.
Let's be clear. These people, and it's both, it's not just the U.S., it's the EU as well. It is not just the neocons. It is the flip side of the coin. It is the so-called humanitarian interventionists, or as Stephen Walt called them, humanitarian imperialists. It crosses borders. It crosses sides of the aisle. These people genuinely, for the most part, actually believe that at the end of the day, or long term, of course, that what they are doing and this aggressive push of both Western rules of world order of the game and their cultural values on the rest of the world is for the good of the people of the world, that they just need to be liberated from whether it's repression or from their brainwashing, whether you're brown skinned, yellow skinned, whatever, deep down inside, you are a Western liberal, in the classical sense of the term liberal, consumer, just waiting to be saved and brought to the one true faith. And that is, this is the real danger involved when we talk about this as an ideology, because it is not simply geopolitics and national interests and, power acting in the interests of power, unable to let go of power. It goes beyond the pure realist function of empire into the ideological belief, this is essentially a fanatical religion.
Let me just say this much. The irony of that is that the folklore here in the post-Cold War period was that it was the ideological constraints placed on the Soviet Union that led to its demise.
I think the reality is that Soviet ideology was far less intrusive than that which we have seen emerge in the United States recently. I think that Soviet leaders during the Cold War, especially in the way they operated their foreign policy, always had a much better grasp of the realities of situations than US leaders do. I read recently a book by a British ambassador on Soviet decision-making leading up to the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan in 1979. And what was very interesting about that was to read the debates that happened at that time within the Politburo and the Central Committee. And it was quite interesting that there was a much more wider and far more informed debate with far less of the grandstanding that you see happening in the West today. And I think that is, I think that we have an ideology that has gone a whole stage further, emerging in the United States, and a very messianic one, actually. And
yes,
this is, I think, what the point that Mark was saying. You get the impression sometimes with some of the people who hold this ideology that they really do believe that they're living in some kind of end of days world where there is a great future waiting. And of course, if that doesn't happen, then that is in fact a very dangerous situation. The Soviets never believed that. They never for any moment in their history really believed that communism was just round the corner. It was always something that had to be built, to use their own language.
Mm-hmm. And was, you know, if you look to American history, there was a point in time with the Nixon administration, essentially, where although ideology may have ruled in terms of strategy, in terms of tactics, they went to Kissinger's realpolitik.
Exactly.
And
yes.
Where it led them wasn't to confrontation, but rather to de-escalation of tensions and to attempt to, you know, to rapprochement they called détente at the time.
Stephen Walt, who is the head of the JFK School of Government at Harvard and a frequent contributor to the Foreign Policy, is a realist who has written about that very thing multiple times. He continually writes about it, and he writes about how a big part of the problem with U.S. foreign policy is the death of this realism that was so exemplified, and I did this so much, you asked so much credit during the, you know, the Nixon Kissinger years, and what has replaced it. You know, again, we don't have to talk right, left, whether it's neocon or, you know, humanitarian interventionists. They're both flip sides of the same imperial coin. And if I could just go back to what Alex was saying there. This is extremely dangerous, this belief in apocalyptic end times. Because we have particularly, of course, have this strain in the United States where there's a whole neocon religious school which sees itself connected and the very strong supporters of Israel. They really do believe in this type of end times messianism. But how much this is an echo of their bastard child ISIS, whose official caliphate ideology also sees themselves as part of an end times narrative, where they believe that they will fight this battle against the Reem and bring about the end of this world and the rebirth of the new one in battles, in the Aleppo Plains.
So as you move towards World War III, you're seeing in some places a constituency in favor of it.
Well, if we're talking about ISIS, of course, they are in favor of it. And this is really quite important because, of course, ISIS, the ideology that Mark was just describing, this end time messianic vision that they have. An apocalyptic death thing is not something that was historically part of Islam. I'm not saying it's not Islamic, but if you look at Islamic history, it's not something that was a feature of Islamic history and philosophy. And now it's come, and one wonders very much where it's come from. And I think also, we had all these people writing a couple of years ago about how we were looking at the end of history. And in so many senses, though, there is a belief here that the United States does represent the culmination of history and the culmination of historical development. And that's why you have all this pressure and why you have all this violence and why I feel personally it is creating all these very strange ideas. I mean, Ukrainian right-wing nationalist political language also sometimes has a kind of apocalyptic quality if you listen to it or read it carefully. And very disturbing it is. By contrast, I should say, if we come back to the Eurasian states, one of the things that you notice there is that they are extraordinarily realist, whatever their ideology might be, whether it's nominally communist in China or Shiite in Iran or whatever it is in Russia, they do not talk or think in these terms. And if they have a weakness, I think that it is sometimes the case that the Eurasian powers do not understand how what they're up against, if you like, with people who hold these ideas.
Okay, we have about 3 minutes, so if you want to take a minute each, Mark.
Yeah, what Alex is touching on there, I mean, we call that when we talk about, you know, Marxist theory, you know, most of our leaders are out there are leftists, and post-leftists like myself anyway. But we're talking about a historical imperative there. This is a, you know, a Western civilization as whole. I think, you know, we can talk about it in terms of classical liberalism, you know, rather than, you know, the specific U.S. or EU domestic political interpretations of the world. But when we talk about, you know, the U.S. and the EU seeing themselves as the culmination of history, the, you know, the pinnacle, the end of history, and the last man, as Francis Fukuyama falsely called it. This is a historical imperative, you know, no different than the, you know, the messianic historical imperative that, you know, underlined, you know, the strong adherence of Marxist-Leninist dogma, which, you know, we see now, you know, as post-leftists anyway, that, you know, the problem is this export of ideology or faith or liberalism or communism to other cultures where it doesn't have, you know, a domestic historical base built up to accept and to qualify it. And religious, ethnic divides only are exacerbated by this this phenomenon, and it has led to so much problems. No matter Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Yemen, no matter how many times we see it repeated, they still it doesn't devolve them from the belief. No. That you can export their ideology and recreate their system and build nations in their own image around the world. They keep falling back on the same arguments again and again and again.
It is, however, also a dead end because, of course, what Mark has just listed is a succession of failures. And when you are running a foreign policy or an economic policy or any kind of policy that is so divorced from reality and is so driven, not I think just by ideology, but by this very strange set of ideas that really looks beyond reality, creates your own reality, to use a comment that Rove is supposed to have said,
then
you're not really going to achieve very much positively. And it's perhaps early to say this. I live in Britain, which is in some ways the heartland of liberalism. And one of the interesting things is to see how there is spreading disillusion here because people are starting to question where all this is going. And there was, I think, much more opposition, for example, to this war in Syria than I think the media have been reflecting.
Okay. Mark, Alex, thanks a lot for your time. A pleasure. And
Thank you. Pleasure.
Honor and a pleasure, gentlemen, as always.
Thanks.
Awesome.
Take care. Be well. You've been listening to CPR Sundays with Eric Dreitzer and Mark Sloboda. I'm Don DeBar, your host. Look forward to seeing you drop in again next week. Thanks for listening.